The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula Le Guin, copyright 1969 by Ursula K. Le Guin, was published by arrangement with Warner Audio Publishing, Incorporated, and was produced in 1986 by Books on Tape, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin. This book contains 304 pages and 21 chapters. The following material appears on the dust jacket of the book. From field notes of Ong Tat Opong, investigator of the first ecumenical landing party of Gethen, Winter Cycle 93, EY 1448. Our entire pattern of social-sexual interaction is non-existent here. The Gethenians do not see one another as men or women. This is almost impossible for our imaginations to accept. After all, what is the first question we ask about a newborn baby? Yet you cannot think of a Gethenian as it. They are not neuters. They are potentials. During each sexual cycle, they may develop in either direction for the duration of that cycle. No physiological habit is established, and the mother of several children may be the father of several more. There is no division of humanity into strong and weak halves, protected, protective. One is respected and judged only as a human being. You cannot cast a Gethenian in the role of man or woman while adopting towards him a corresponding role dependent on your expectations of the interactions between persons of the same or opposite sex. It is an appalling experience for a Terran. Ursula Kroeber Le Guin, daughter of A.L. Kroeber, anthropologist, and Theodora Kroeber, author, was born in Berkeley, California in 1929. She attended college at Radcliffe in Columbia and married C.A. Le Guin in Paris in 1951. The Le Guins and their three children live in Portland, Oregon. Ursula K. Le Guin's novels include Rokanan's World, Planet of Exile, City of Illusions, and The Left Hand of Darkness, all published by Ace Books. The Left Hand of Darkness, in particular, attracted wide attention and strong praise. It was awarded both the Nebula and the Hugo Awards. With the awarding of the 1975 Hugo and Nebula Awards to The Dispossessed, Ursula K. Le Guin became the first author to win both awards twice for novel. Dedication for Charles. Sine qua non. Introduction. Science fiction is often described and even defined as extrapolative. The science fiction writer is supposed to take a trend or phenomenon of the here and now, purify and intensify it for dramatic effect, and extend it into the future. If this goes on, this is what will happen. A prediction is made. Method and results much resemble those of a scientist who feeds large doses of a purified and concentrated food additive to mice in order to predict what may happen to people who eat it in small quantities for a long time. The outcome seems almost inevitably to be cancer. So does the outcome of extrapolation. Strictly extrapolative works of science fiction generally arrive about where the Club of Rome arrives, somewhere between the gradual extinction of human liberty and the total extinction of terrestrial life. This may explain why many people who do not read science fiction describe it as escapist, but when questioned further admit they do not read it because it's so depressing. Almost anything carried to its logical extreme becomes depressing, if not carcinogenic. Fortunately, though extrapolation is an element in science fiction, it isn't the name of the game by any means. It is far too rationalist and simplistic to satisfy the imaginative mind, whether the writers or the readers. Variables are the spice of life. This book is not extrapolative. If you like, you can read it and a lot of other science fiction as a thought experiment. Let's say, says Mary Shelley, that a young doctor creates a human being in his laboratory. Let's say, says Philip K. Dick, that the Allies lost the Second World War. Let's say this or that is such and so, and see what happens. In a story so conceived, the moral complexity proper to the modern novel need not be sacrificed, nor is there any built-in dead end. Thought and intuition can move freely within bounds set only by the terms of the experiment, which may be very large indeed. The purpose of a thought experiment, as the term was used by Schrödinger and other physicists, is not to predict the future. Indeed, Schrödinger's most famous thought experiment goes to show that the future, on the quantum level, cannot be predicted, but to describe reality, the present world. Science fiction is not predictive, it is descriptive. Predictions are uttered by prophets, free of charge, by clairvoyants, who usually charge a fee and are therefore more honored in their day than prophets, and by futurologists, salaried. Prediction is the business of prophets, clairvoyants, and futurologists. It is not the business of novelists. A novelist's business is lying. The Weather Bureau will tell you what next Tuesday will be like, and the Rand Corporation will tell you what the 21st century will be like. I don't recommend that you turn to the writers of fiction for such information. It's none of their business. All they're trying to do is tell you what they're like and what you're like, what's going on, what the weather is now, today, this moment, the rain, the sunlight. Look. Open your eyes. Listen. Listen. That is what the novelists say. But they don't tell you what you will see and hear. All they can tell you is what they have seen and heard in their time, in this world. A third of it spent in sleep and dreaming, another third of it spent in telling lies. The truth against the world. Yes, certainly. Fiction writers, at least in their braver moments, do desire the truth. To know it, speak it, serve it. But they go about it in a peculiar and devious way which consists in inventing persons, places, and events which never did and never will exist or occur, and telling about these fictions in detail and at length and with a great deal of emotion. And then when they are done writing down this pack of lies, they say, there, that's the truth. They may use all kinds of facts to support their tissue of lies. They may describe the Marshalsea prison, which was a real place, or the Battle of Borodino, which really was fought, or the process of cloning, which really takes place in laboratories, or the deterioration of a personality, which is described in real textbooks of psychology, and so on. This weight of verifiable place-event-phenomenon behavior makes the reader forget that he is reading a pure invention. A history that never took place anywhere but in that unlocalizable region, the author's mind. In fact, while we read a novel, we are insane, bonkers. We believe in the existence of people who aren't there. We hear their voices. We watch the Battle of Borodino with them. We may even become Napoleon. Sanity returns in most cases when the book is closed. Is it any wonder that no truly respectable society has ever trusted its artists? But our society, being troubled and bewildered, seeking guidance, sometimes puts an entirely mistaken trust in its artists, using them as prophets and futurologists. I do not say that artists cannot be seers, inspired, that the Awen cannot come upon them and the gods speak through them. Who would be an artist if they did not believe that that happens, if they did not know it happens, because they have felt the God within them use their tongue, their hands? Maybe only once in their lives, but once is enough. Nor would I say that the artist alone is so burdened and so privileged. The scientist is another who prepares, who makes ready, working day and night, sleeping and awake, for inspiration. As Pythagoras knew, the God may speak in the forms of geometry as well as in the shapes of dreams, in the harmony of pure thought as well as in the harmony of sounds, in numbers as well as in words. But it is words that make the trouble and confusion. We are asked now to consider words as useful in only one way, as signs. Our philosophers, some of them, would have us agree that a word, sentence, statement, has value only insofar as it has one single meaning, points to one fact which is comprehensible to the rational intellect, logically sound, and, ideally, quantifiable. Apollo, the god of light, of reason, of proportion, harmony, number, Apollo blinds those who press too close in worship. Don't look straight at the sun. Go into a dark bar for a bit and have a beer with Dionysius every now and then. I talk about the gods. I am an atheist. But I am an artist, too, and therefore a liar. Distrust everything I say. I am telling the truth. The only truth I can understand or express is, logically defined, a lie. Psychologically defined, a symbol. Aesthetically defined, a metaphor. Oh, it's lovely to be invited to participate in futurological congresses where systems science displays its grand apocalyptic graphs, to be asked to tell the newspapers what America will be like in 2001 and all that, but it's a terrible mistake. I write science fiction, and science fiction isn't about the future. I don't know any more about the future than you do, and very likely less. This book is not about the future. Yes, it begins by announcing that it's set in the ecumenical year 1490 to 97, but surely you don't believe that. Yes, indeed, the people in it are androgynous, but that doesn't mean that I'm predicting that in a millennium or so we will all be androgynous, or announcing that I think we damned well ought to be androgynous. I'm merely observing, in the peculiar, devious, and thought-experimental manner proper to science fiction, that if you look at us at certain odd times of day in certain weathers, we already are. I am not predicting or prescribing. I am describing. I am describing certain aspects of psychological reality in the novelist's way, which is by inventing elaborately circumstantial lies. In reading a novel, any novel, we have to know perfectly well that the whole thing is nonsense, and then, while reading, believe every word of it. Finally, when we're done with it, we may find, if it's a good novel, that we're a bit different from what we were before we read it, that we have been changed a little, as if by having met a new face, crossed a street we never crossed before. But it's very hard to say just what we learned, how we were changed. The artist deals with what cannot be said in words. The artist whose medium is fiction does this in words. The novelist says in words what cannot be said in words. Words can be used thus paradoxically, because they have, along with the semiotic usage, a symbolic or metaphoric usage. They also have a sound, a fact the linguistic positivists take no interest in. A sentence or paragraph is like a chord or harmonic sequence in music. Its meaning may be more clearly understood by the attentive ear, even though it is read in silence, than by the attentive intellect. All fiction is metaphor. Science fiction is metaphor. What sets it apart from older forms of fiction seems to be its use of new metaphors drawn from certain great dominants of our contemporary life. Science, all the sciences, and technology, and the relativistic and the historical outlook among them. Space travel is one of these metaphors. So is an alternative society, an alternative biology. The future is another. The future in fiction is a metaphor. A metaphor for what? If I could have said it non-metaphorically, I would not have written all these words, this novel. And Genly I would never have sat down at my desk and used up my ink and typewriter ribbon in informing me and you, rather solemnly, that the truth is a matter of the imagination. Ursula K. Le Guin. Chapter 1. A Parade in Erinrung. From the Archives of Hein, transcript of Ansible, document 01-01101-934-2, Gethen. To the Stabil on Olul. Report from Genly I. First Mobile on Gethen. Winter. Heinisch Cycle 9-3. Ecumenical Year 1490-97. I'll make my report as if I told a story, for I was taught as a child on my home world that truth is a matter of the imagination. The soundest fact may fail or prevail in the style of its telling, like that singular organic jewel of our seas, which grows brighter as one woman wears it and worn by another dulls and goes to dust. Facts are no more solid, coherent, round and real than pearls are, but both are sensitive. The story is not all mine, nor told by me alone. Indeed, I am not sure whose story it is. You can judge better. But it is all one, and if at moments the facts seem to alter with an altered voice, why then you can choose the fact you like best. Yet none of them are false, and it is all one story. It starts on the 44th diurnal of the year 1491, which on the planet Winter, in the nation Karhide, was Ardhahahad Tua, or the 22nd day of the third month of spring in the year 1. It is always the year 1 here. Only the dating of every past and future year changes each New Year's day as one counts backwards or forwards from the unitary now. So it was spring of the year 1 in Erinrung, capital city of Karhide, and I was in peril of my life and did not know it. I was in a parade. I walked just behind the Gossowers and just before the king. It was raining. Rain clouds over dark towers, rain falling in deep streets, a dark, storm-beaten city of stone through which one vein of gold winds slowly. First come merchants, potentates, and artisans of the city Erinrung, rank after rank, magnificently clothed, advancing through the rain as comfortably as fish through the sea. Their faces are keen and calm. They do not march in step. This is a parade with no soldiers, not even imitation soldiers. Next come the lords and mayors and representatives. One person, or 5, or 45, or 400, from each domain and co-domain of Karhide, a vast ornate procession that moves to the music of metal horns and hollow blocks of bone and wood and the dry, pure lilting of electric flutes. The various banners of the great domains tangle in a rain-beaten confusion of color, with the yellow pennants that bedeck the way, and the various musics of each group clash and interweave in many rhythms, echoing in the deep stone street. Next, a troop of jugglers with polished spheres of gold, which they hurl up high in flashing flights, and catch and hurl again, making fountain jets of bright jugglery. All at once, as if they had literally caught the light, the gold spheres blaze bright as glass. The sun is breaking through. Next, 40 men in yellow playing Gossowers. The Gossower, played only in the king's presence, produces a preposterous, disconsolate bellow. 40 of them, played together, shake one's reason, shake the towers of Erinrung, shake down a last spatter of rain from the windy clouds. If this is the royal music, no wonder the kings of Karhide are all mad. Next, the royal party, guards and functionaries and dignitaries of the city, and the court, deputies, senators, chancellors, ambassadors, lords of the kingdom, none of them keeping step or rank, yet walking with great dignity. And among them is King Argovan, 15, in white tunic and shirt and breeches, with leggings of saffron leather and a peaked yellow cap. A gold finger ring is his only adornment and sign of office. Behind this group, 8 sturdy fellows bear the royal litter, rough with yellow sapphires, in which no king has ridden for centuries, a ceremonial relic of the very long ago. By the litter walk 8 guards, armed with foray guns, also relics of a more barbaric past, but not empty ones, being loaded with pellets of soft iron. Death walks behind the king. Behind Death come the students of the artisan schools, the colleges, the trades, and the king's hearths. Long lines of children and young people in white and red and gold and green. And finally, a number of soft-running, slow, dark cars end the parade. The royal party, myself among them, gather on a platform of new timbers beside the unfinished arch of the river gate. The occasion of the parade is the completion of that arch, which completes the new road and river port of Erenrang, a great operation of dredging and building and road-making which has taken 5 years and will distinguish Argovan XV's reign in the annals of Carhide. We are all squeezed rather tight on the platform in our damp and massive finery. The rain is gone. The sun shines on us, the splendid, radiant, traitorous sun of winter. I remark to the person on my left, "It's hot. It's really hot." The person on my left, a stocky dark carhider with sleek and heavy hair, wearing a heavy overtunic of green leather worked with gold, and a heavy white shirt, and heavy breeches, and a neck chain of heavy silver links a hand broad. This person, sweating heavily, replies, "So it is." All about us, as we stand jammed on our platform, lie the faces of the people of the city, upturned like a shoal of brown, round pebbles, mica glittering with thousands of watching eyes. Now the king ascends a gangplank of raw timbers that leads from the platform up to the top of the arch, whose unjoined piers tower over crown and wharves and rivers. As he mounts, the crowd stirs and speaks in a vast murmur. "Argovan." He makes no response. They expect none. Gossowers blow a thunderous, discordant blast. Cease. Silence. The sun shines on city, river, crowd, and king. Masons below have set an electric winch going, and as the king mounts higher, the keystone of the arch goes up past him in its sling, is raised, settled, and fitted almost soundlessly, great ton-weight block though it is, into the gap between the two piers, making them one thing, an arch. A mason with trowel and bucket awaits the king up on the scaffolding. All the other workmen descend by rope ladders like a swarm of fleas. The king and the mason kneel high between the river and the sun on their bit of planking. Taking the trowel, the king begins to mortar the long joints of the keystone. He does not dab at it and give the trowel back to the mason, but sets to work methodically. The cement he uses is a pinkish color, different from the rest of the mortar work, and after 5 or 10 minutes of watching the king bee work, I ask the person on my left, "Are your keystones always set in a red cement?" For the same color is plain around the keystone of each arch of the old bridge that soars beautifully over the river upstream from the arch. Wiping sweat from his dark forehead, the man, I must say, having said he and his, the man answers, "Very long ago a keystone was always set in with a mortar of ground bones mixed with blood. Human bones, human blood. Without the blood bond, the arch would fall, you see. We use the blood of animals these days." So he often speaks, frank yet cautious, ironic, as if always aware that I see and judge as an alien. A singular awareness in one of so isolate a race and so high a rank. He is one of the most powerful men in the country. I am not sure of the proper historical equivalent of his position, vizier or prime minister or counselor. The Karhadish word for it means the king's ear. He is lord of a domain and lord of the kingdom, a mover of great events. His name is Therem, Harth, Rem, or Estravan. The king seems to be finished with his masonry work, and I rejoice. But crossing under the rise of the arch on his spider web of planks, he starts in on the other side of the keystone, which after all has two sides. It doesn't do to be impatient in Karhide. They are anything but a phlegmatic people, yet they are obdurate, they are pertinacious, they finish plastering joints. The crowds on the Cess embankment are content to watch the king work. But I am bored and hot. I have never before been hot on winter. I never will be again, yet I fail to appreciate the event. I am dressed for the ice age and not for the sunshine, in layers and layers of clothing, woven plant fiber, artificial fiber, fur, leather, a massive armor against the cold, within which I now wilt like a radish leaf. For distraction, I look at the crowds and the other paraders drawn up around the platform, their domain and clan banners hanging still and bright in sunlight. And idly, I ask Estravan what this banner is and that one and the other. He knows each one I ask about, though there are hundreds, some from remote domains, hearths and triblets of the Pairing Storm Border and Kermland. I'm from Kermland myself, he says, when I admire his knowledge. Anyhow, it's my business to know the domains. They are Karhide. To govern this land is to govern its lords. Not that it's ever been done. Do you know the saying, Karhide is not a nation, but a family quarrel? I haven't, and I suspect that Estravan made it up. It has his stamp. At this point, another member of the Karomi, the upper chamber or parliament which Estravan heads, pushes and squeezes away up close to him and begins talking to him. This is the king's cousin, Permer Hargerem Irtibi. His voice is very low as he speaks to Estravan, his posture faintly insolent, his smile frequent. Estravan, sweating like ice in the sun, stays slick and cold as ice, answering Tibby's murmurs aloud in a tone whose commonplace politeness makes the other look rather a fool. I listen as I watch the king grouting away, but understand nothing except the animosity between Tibby and Estravan. It's nothing to do with me in any case, and I am simply interested in the behavior of these people who rule a nation in the old-fashioned sense, who govern the fortunes of 20 million other people. Power has become so subtle and complex a thing in the ways taken by the ecumen that only a subtle mind can watch it work. Here it is still limited, still visible. In Estravan, for instance, one feels the man's power as an augmentation of his character. He cannot make an empty gesture or say a word that is not listened to. He knows it, and the knowledge gives him more reality than most people own. A solidness of being, a substantiality, a human grandeur. Nothing succeeds like success. I don't trust Estravan, whose motives are forever obscure. I don't like him, yet I feel and respond to his authority as surely as I do to the warmth of the sun. Even as I think this, the world sun dims between clouds regathering, and soon a flaw of rain runs sparse and hard upriver, spattering the crowds on the embankment, darkening the sky. As the king comes down the gangplank, the light breaks through a last time, and his white figure and the great arch stand out a moment, vivid and splendid, against the storm-darkened south. The clouds close. A cold wind comes, tearing up Port and Palace Street. The river goes gray. The trees on the embankment shudder. The parade is over. Half an hour later, it is snowing. As the king's car drove off up Port and Palace Street, and the crowds began to move like a rocky shingle rolled by a slow tide, Estravan turned to me again and said, "Will you have supper with me tonight, Mr. I?" I accepted with more surprise than pleasure. Estravan had done a great deal for me in the last 6 or 8 months, but I did not expect or desire such a show of personal favor as an invitation to his house. Hagirem Irtibi was still close to us, overhearing, and I felt that he was meant to overhear. Annoyed by this sense of effeminate intrigue, I got off the platform and lost myself in the mob, crouching and slouching somewhat to do so. I'm not much taller than the Gathenian norm, but the difference is most noticeable in a crowd. That's him. Look, there's the envoy. Of course, that was part of my job, but it was a part that got harder, not easier, as time went on. More and more often, I longed for anonymity, for sameness. I craved to be like everybody else. A couple of blocks up Brewery Street, I turned off toward my lodgings, and suddenly, there where the crowd thinned out, found Tibby walking beside me. "A flawless event," said the king's cousin, smiling at me. His long, clean, yellow teeth appeared and disappeared in a yellow face all webbed, though he was not an old man, with fine, soft wrinkles. "A good augury for the success of the new port," I said. "Yes, indeed." More teeth. "The ceremony of the keystone is most impressive." "Yes, indeed. That ceremony descends to us from very long ago. But no doubt Lord Estravan explained all that to you." "Lord Estravan is most obliging." I was trying to speak insipidly, yet everything I said to Tibby seemed to take on a double meaning. "Oh, very much indeed," said Tibby. "Indeed, Lord Estravan is famous for his kindness to foreigners." He smiled again, and every tooth seemed to have a meaning, double, multiple, 32 different meanings. "Few foreigners are so foreign as I, Lord Tibby. I am very grateful for kindnesses." "Yes, indeed, yes, indeed. And gratitude's a noble, rare emotion, much praised by the poets. Rare above all here in Erinrang, no doubt, because it's impracticable. This is a hard age we live in, an ungrateful age. Things aren't as they were in our grandparents' day, are they?" "I scarcely know, sir, but I've heard the same lament on other worlds." Tibby stared at me for some while as if establishing lunacy. Then he brought out the long yellow teeth. "Ah, yes, yes, indeed. I keep forgetting that you come from another planet. But, of course, that's not a matter you ever forget. Though no doubt life would be much sounder and simpler and safer for you here in Erinrang if you could forget it, eh?" "Yes, indeed." "Here's my car. I had it wait here out of the way. I'd like to offer to drive you to your island, but must forego the privilege, as I'm due at the king's house very shortly. And poor relations must be in good time, as the saying is, eh?" "Yes, indeed," said the king's cousin, climbing into his little black electric car, teeth bared across his shoulder at me, eyes veiled by a net of wrinkles. I walked on home to my island. Karhash Island, the usual word for the apartment boarding house buildings that house the greatest part of the urban populations of Karhide. Islands contain 20 to 200 private rooms. Meals are communal. Some are run as hotels, others as cooperative communes. Others combine these types. They are certainly an urban adaptation of the fundamental Karhidish institution of the hearth, though lacking, of course, the topical and genealogical stability of the hearth. Its front garden was revealed now that the last of the winter snow had melted, and the winter doors, 10 feet above ground, were sealed off for a few months, till the autumn and the deep snow should return. Around at the side of the building, in the mud and the ice, and the quick, soft, rank spring growth of the garden, a young couple stood talking. Their right hands were clasped. They were in the first phase of Kemmer. The large, soft snow danced about them as they stood barefoot in the icy mud, hands clasped, eyes all for each other. Spring on winter. I had dinner at my island, and at fourth hour, striking on the gongs of Remy Tower, I was at the palace, ready for supper. Karhiders eat 4 solid meals a day, breakfast, lunch, dinner, supper, along with a lot of adventitious nibbling and gobbling in between. There are no large meat animals on winter, and no mammalian products, milk, butter, or cheese. The only high-protein, high-carbohydrate foods are the various kinds of eggs, fish, nuts, and the Heinisch grains. A low-grade diet for a bitter climate, and one must refuel often. I had got used to eating, as it seemed, every few minutes. It wasn't until later in that year that I discovered the Gathenians have perfected the technique not only of perpetually stuffing,
but also of indefinitely starving. The snow still fell, a mild spring blizzard much pleasanter than the relentless rain of the thaw just past. I made my way to and through the palace in the quiet and pale darkness of snowfall, losing my way only once. The palace of Erenrang is an inner city, a walled wilderness of palaces, towers, gardens, courtyards, cloisters, roofed bridgeways, roofless tunnel walks, small forests and dungeon keeps, the products of centuries of paranoia on a grand scale. Over it all rise the grim, red, elaborate walls of the royal house, which, though in perpetual use, is inhabited by no one beside the king himself. Everyone else, servants, staff, lords, ministers, parliamentarians, guards, or whatever, sleeps in another palace, or fort, or keep, or barracks, or house, inside the walls. Estrovan's house, sign of the king's high favor, was the corner red dwelling built 440 years ago for Harmes, beloved Kemmering of Emron III, whose beauty is still celebrated, and who was abducted, mutilated, and rendered imbecile by hirelings of the Innerland faction. Emron III died 40 years after, still wreaking vengeance on his unhappy country. Emron the ill-fated. The tragedy is so old that its horror has leached away, and only a certain air of faithlessness and melancholy clings to the stones and shadows of the house. The garden was small and walled. Sarum trees leaned over a rocky pool. In dim shafts of light from the windows of the house, I saw snowflakes and the thread-like white spore cases of the trees falling softly together onto the dark water. Estrovan stood waiting for me, bareheaded and coatless in the cold, watching that small, secret, ceaseless descent of snow and seeds in the night. He greeted me quietly and brought me into the house. There were no other guests. I wondered at this, but we went to table at once, and one does not talk business while eating. Besides, my wonder was diverted to the meal, which was superb. Even the eternal bread apples, transmuted by a cook whose art I heartily praised. After supper, by the fire, we drank hot beer. On a world where a common table implement is a little device with which you crack the ice that has formed on your drink between draughts, hot beer is a thing you come to appreciate. Estrovan had conversed amiably at table. Now, sitting across the hearth from me, he was quiet. Though I had been nearly 2 years on Winter, I was still far from being able to see the people of the planet through their own eyes. I tried to, but my efforts took the form of self-consciously seeing a Gathenian first as a man, then as a woman, forcing him into those categories so irrelevant to his nature and so essential to my own. Thus, as I sipped my smoking sour beer, I thought that, at table, Estrovan's performance had been womanly, all charm and tact, and lack of substance, specious and adroit. Was it, in fact, perhaps this soft, supple femininity that I disliked and distrusted in him? For it was impossible to think of him as a woman, that dark, ironic, powerful presence near me in the firelit darkness. And yet, whenever I thought of him as a man, I felt a sense of falseness, of imposture. In him, or in my own attitude towards him, his voice was soft and rather resonant, but not deep. Scarcely a man's voice, but scarcely a woman's voice either. But what was it saying? "I'm sorry," he was saying, "that I've had to forestall for so long this pleasure of having you in my house. And to that extent, at least, I'm glad there's no longer any question of patronage between us." I puzzled at this a while. He had certainly been my patron in court until now. Did he mean that the audience he had arranged for me with the king tomorrow had raised me to an equality with himself? "I don't think I follow you," I said. At that he was silent, evidently also puzzled. "Well, you understand," he said at last, "being here, you understand that I am no longer acting on your behalf with the king, of course." He spoke as if ashamed of me, not of himself. Clearly there was a significance in his invitation and my acceptance of it, which I had missed. But my blunder was in manners, his in morals. All I thought at first was that I had been right all along not to trust Estrovan. He was not merely adroit and not merely powerful. He was faithless. All these months in Irinrang, it had been he who listened to me, who answered my questions, sent physicians and engineers to verify the alienness of my physique and my ship, introduced me to people I needed to know, and gradually elevated me from my first year's status as a highly imaginative monster to my present recognition as the mysterious envoy about to be received by the king. Now, having got me up on that dangerous eminence, he suddenly and coolly announced he was withdrawing his support. "You've led me to rely on you." It was ill done. "Do you mean that having arranged this audience, you haven't spoken in favor of my mission to the king as you..." I had the sense to stop short of promised. "I can't." I was very angry, but I met neither anger nor apology in him. "Will you tell me why?"